From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Nick Hornby. His books High Fidelity, Fever Pitch, and About a Boy were adapted into films. His newest novel, A Long Way Down, tells the story of four strangers who've gone to the rooftop of a 15-story building intending to jump to their deaths. It's now out in paperback. Also, Bruce Springsteen has a new album of folk songs made popular by Pete Seeger. Coming up, we listen back to a 1984 interview with the folk legend himself, Pete Seeger. And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Da Vinci Code. The much-anticipated blockbuster based on Dan Brown's bestseller opens today. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest is the British writer Nick Hornby. His first novel, High Fidelity, made him a favorite of rock and roll loving readers. It was adapted into a film starring John Cusack. High Fidelity was about the owner of a used record store who defines himself by his taste in music, movies, and books, and judges other people by theirs. Hornby's memoir, Fever Pitch, and his novel About a Boy were also adapted into films. His latest novel, A Long Way Down, has just come out in paperback. A Long Way Down tells the stories of four people who've decided to end their lives on New Year's Eve by jumping off the roof of a building in London well known as a destination for jumpers. But when these four strangers run into each other on the roof, instead of jumping, they end up talking and, in doing so, distract themselves from their plans. They agree to postpone their suicides, and in the meantime, the disparate members of this group become enmeshed in each other's lives. The novel is told from the alternating points of view of the four characters. Terry Gross spoke with Nick Hornby last year when the novel was published.
Nick Hornby, welcome back to Fresh Air. One of the characters in your novel who gets to the roof and intends on committing suicide is surprised to find that there are three other people already there with the same intention. And he looks at them and he thinks, suicide wasn't invented for people like this. It was invented for people like Virginia Woolf and Nick Drake and me. Suicide was supposed to be cool. So obviously you've thought about the whole romance surrounding suicide in popular culture. Did you want your novel to kind of have a conversation with other books and movies and poetry and popular culture about suicide?
Yes, in part. I mean, it's very much, I think, in our culture, and it is something that is romanticized by a certain section of a kind of hip young population. But there are all kinds of books and movies mentioned in A Long Way Down, and JJ, the musician, he is somebody who buys into that myth. But one of the things I wanted to do was point out at the same time the kind of banality of it as well.
Yes, and another thing I like about that quote there is it shows even if you think you're on the verge of suicide, you can still be very snobbish about other people and about popular culture.
Well, yeah, one of the things that kind of was interesting me in writing the book was that, you know, of course, life goes on until it stops, and you're going to have the same attitudes, and you're going to have you know, songs that you're thinking about, people you're thinking about, bus tickets in your pocket. The detritus of life is carried right to the very end if you're going to cut it off like that.
What about the reality of suicide as opposed to like the pop culture mystique around it? Do you have friends or family who have ever tried or succeeded at suicide?
Well, I lost a friend when I was quite young, when 21, 22, around about then. That was the most shocking loss of that kind that I've experienced.
Were you surprised?
He was one of those guys. He had scars on his wrists from a previous attempt, and I suppose we all thought that it was something he'd outgrown. But, there was no sign of it as far as we knew prior to it happening, so I was surprised.
How did he do it?
He did the rubber hose and the exhaust pipe.
Which strikes me as a relatively painless way to go. Not that I've ever experienced it, but the characters in your novel who plan to take their lives, plan to jump off the roof of a high rise. And that always seems to me like one of the most horrible ways of doing it. I mean, I think, you know, pills, a gun, gas, less painful. You know, jumping off a high roof always seems to me like the most self-punishing or one of the most self-punishing forms of suicide, because there's not only that sense of impact, there's also that fear I think you would have that on the way down you would have all the anxiety thinking about that moment of impact, and there'd be that those extra few seconds where you could entertain doubt.
Well, one of the most remarkable things I read when I was preparing for this book was a magazine article in The New Yorker about people who jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And I do quote this line in the book, an interview with a survivor, someone who'd hit the water but survived. And he said that he realized very quickly after jumping that there was only one thing wrong with his life, and that was that he just jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge.
So why did you choose, why do these characters choose, you know, suicide by jumping off a roof? Or entertain the idea of suicide by jumping off a roof?
Well, I have to say, and I try and be practical and pragmatic wherever possible, rather than talk about artistic myths, but I have to say that the idea wouldn't have worked very well if they'd sat in their own cars and taken pills. I wanted them to meet each other, and, you know, I wanted them to be in a place where people killed themselves. But there was also the sense, yes, it's a very self-hating thing to do, I think, and at least three of the characters are in a very self-loathing state of mind. And I like the idea, when I was thinking about it, that if you're talking about circumstance, then every single character is going to have some kind of a dramatic story, which, of course, is something that you're looking for if you write.
Why did you choose suicide in the first place? Why examine people's lives who are on the verge of ending their lives?
Well, there are various answers to that. One of the things is that with my books, I want to try and go as dark as I can and as funny as I can within a domestic context, because I know that my characters are never actually going to do that anything that extreme in terms of the big picture. I don't think they're ever going to go to war. I can't imagine writing about history. So I'm stuck with people in the here and now. And if you want to push things on in writing about that, then obviously I'm looking for situations where people are in extremis. And, you know, it is something that is among us, that people want to take their own lives or feel like taking their own lives, you know, probably within a few hundred yards of where we're sitting now.
One of the characters in the book wants to kill himself because he always wanted to be a rock star and his band fell apart and he doesn't think he's going to make it. And that's a character that anybody who's read you knows that you would be familiar with. Another character has like a morning TV show in England, and he's been disgraced because he slept with a 15-year-old. And it's pop enough, people would kind of get your connection to it. There's a character who is very, very unlike you. And unlike the kind of characters you've written up before, although there's one connection. And she's a single mother of an autistic son. And your fans and readers know.
I don't think she is, the son is autistic, but is extremely disabled in the book. Sorry.
Oh,
just to...
okay. I guess I've been reading that wrong. I've been projecting my knowledge of you onto her.
Yeah.
How would you describe her son?
I'd say extremely disabled, but it's left vague in the book.
Okay. Well, you do have a son who is autistic.
Yeah.
And but she is in so much unlike you. Let me first have you read a little bit of her story about why she plans on taking her life. One of the ways, I should say before you read this, one of the ways that she's not like you and not like what you usually write about it, she's not ironic. And she's not into popular culture. She wants to kill herself because her son has been such a burden. Why don't you read this passage?
Sure. I only ever had intercourse with one man, and I only had intercourse with that one man once. And the one time in my entire life I had intercourse produced Matty. What are the chances, eh? One in a million? One in 10 million? I don't know. But of course, even one in 10 million means there are a lot of women like me in the world. That's not what you think of when you think of one in 10 million. You don't think, that's a lot of people. What I've come to realise over the years is that we're less protected from bad luck than you could possibly imagine. Because though it doesn't seem fair, having intercourse only the once and ending up with a child who can't walk or talk or even recognise me, well, fairness doesn't really have much to do with it, does it? You only have to have intercourse the once to produce a child, any child. There are no laws that say you can only have a child like Matty if you're married, or if you have lots of other children, or if you sleep with lots of different men. There are no laws like that, even though you and I might think there should be. And once you have a child like Matty, you can't help but feel, well, that's it. That's all my bad luck, a whole lifetime's worth in one bundle. But I'm not sure luck works like that. Matty wouldn't stop me from getting breast cancer or from being mugged. You'd think he should, but he can't. In a way, I'm glad I never had another child, a normal one. I'd have needed more guarantees from God than he could have provided.
That's Nick Hornby reading an excerpt of his new novel, A Long Way Down.
It's got jokes in it as well.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit about the tone of Maureen? And I should mention here that when someone uses an expletive in talking to her, and this is her narrative, you know, she censors it.
She can't bring herself to repeat.
It's like F yeah. dash.
Yes, yes.
So, and I think it's, you're very respectful for her to her in that sense.
Well, I mean, I think in some ways she's the soul of the book mm-hmm. because, I mean, she's absolutely not the author of her own misfortune, even though her religious beliefs mean that sometimes she thinks she is. But you're right that my characters typically, I guess, tend to be pretty tuned in to what's going on. And one of the reasons she's up on the roof, in fact, is because she's been tuned out. I mean, she really hasn't lived a life for these 20 years that she's bringing up the child. So technically, she provided more of a challenge, perhaps, because there was an absence where a life should be, and she's done nothing, whereas all the others have done something.
As a father, was it difficult for you to even entertain the idea that somebody's life would be so burdened by a disabled son that she'd want to take her own life?
No, it's not as much of a stretch, unfortunately, as you'd imagine. It's tough, and I think any parent of an autistic child or of a very disabled child has had some long dark nights of the soul during the child's upbringing. So I knew that I had the empathy for the character to embark on this. It's, you know, she's obviously not me, and her kid isn't my kid, but through having my kid, I've kind of entered into a world that I didn't really know very much about before.
She's not a character who defines her life by popular culture, unlike a lot of your characters. And there's an interesting detail in there. She has posters on her walls of, you know, pop stars and stuff, but they don't reflect an actor's. They don't reflect her taste. They reflect the taste that she thinks her son would have if her son was capable of comprehending or responding to movies and music. How did you come up with that? It's an interesting detail.
Well, I think, again, it's something that you might find yourself thinking about, because there comes a point, if you do have a severely disabled child, where they're given lots of kit when they're born and when they're toddlers, and it's got pictures of dogs on and this and that and the other. And then it kind of, they reach a point where a normal kid might be exercising his or her own taste. So you start to think as a parent, well, is it appropriate now if I start to choose things for my 5-year-old or my 6-year-old, you know, clothes to wear, pictures to put up on the wall? Because, you know, babies, we all make the same decisions equally because they are not capable of expressing anything. So it really came from that, you know, would you do it for a teenager? Would you just keep going? And as Maureen says, you know, he wouldn't understand if he had Gap on his shirt, or I don't even know if he recognizes colors. So any decision that you make is going to be made on his behalf. And she sort of takes it to one step further by putting football players and what have you up on the wall.
Writer Nick Hornby speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with British writer Nick Hornby. His latest novel, A Long Way Down, is out in paperback.
Let me ask you about other characters in your novel besides Maureen. What I'd like to do is run through the characters quickly and just ask you to tell us how these characters relate most to you.
Okay.
Okay. So let's start with Martin, who has a morning TV show, and he's been disgraced because he's slept with a 15-year-old, and he's kind of lost his wife and kids. He's kind of sacrificed his family by doing that. What do you relate to about that?
Well, there's something that I'm actually interested in, which is an increasing tendency in our society to glamorize people who have no talent. And this seems to be a yeah. new situation. I mean, I was thinking actually that, you know, a couple of these characters at least couldn't have existed 50 years ago, and Martin is one of them. And once you're in this situation where you're famous for having no talent whatsoever, what inner resources do you have to cope with anything that might happen to you, or are you just a bubble? And my personal relationship, I suppose, is that over the last few years, I've had my own very, very minor experience of very, very minor celebrity, and it's a weird world, and it does mess with your head a bit. So there were things in there that I was wanting to explore a bit.
Then there's Jess, and she's, what, about 18?
Yeah.
And she's really out of control. She has a terrible temper. She's very difficult to be around. She's very rude and insulting. She's really a troubled kid.
I used to teach a couple like this. Obviously, if you were a teacher, these girls were just completely uncontrollable. And I can remember my Jess equivalent when I was teaching suddenly producing a cigarette in class and lighting it, and me having this argument with her, which ended with the compromise of her sitting near the window. So the smoke went out of the window, and me feeling at the end of the lesson that I had managed to exercise some kind of control. But she stayed with me a lot, that girl, after I stopped teaching. And one of the reasons I think she stayed with me is she became a kind of metaphor, in a way, for a creative process, because she makes things happen. And when you write, you just spend all day trying to make things happen and usually failing. But she can start a fight in an empty room. So all you got to do is follow her around and pick up the pieces, which was what I was doing as a teacher, literally, and as a writer, metaphorically. But it's much more fun as a writer.
Okay, the final character who's on the verge of suicide is JJ. He's the American who was in a rock band. The band's fallen apart. He feels like he's never going to get any further and certainly not going to fulfill his dream of being a rock star. What do you relate to about him?
Well, he's the most directly autobiographical in that when I was JJ's age, I thought that was me. I mean, I'd graduated in 1979, and by, I guess, 1989, I hadn't had anything published, and I was drifting in and out of work. And I found it really scary because peers, you know, fellow college graduates were kind of disappearing off into the distance in terms of jobs and careers and family. And I just didn't want to be pathetic and that to come back in when I was 40 or 50 and say, no, I really think the next book I write will be the one. And I found it a very frightening time in my life.
Johnny Depp has bought the film rights to your new novel, A Long Way Down, and which character is he going to play in it?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, he's talking about being a producer, but if he's mentioned a character, it's the character of Martin, which I think, respect to him, because he's good-looking enough to have played the character of the rock star, but he knows that he's a man over 40. So I think it's interesting that he should look at that one.
Have you, I figure you have, but have you gone to see all of the movie adaptations of
your novels? I haven't been standoffish. I haven't really been involved, but people have been really nice to me and respectful and inclusive, and they've always wanted me to go and see cuts of movies and they've wanted me to read drafts, and I actually, it's more a lack of patience rather than a lack of interest. That of course, you know, when the first draft comes, you're really excited to read it, but by the 11th, you really can't remember the difference between this draft and the last draft. And I can remember Stephen Frears when he was making High Fidelity, I'd seen a cut on something like the Monday, and on the Wednesday, I got this phone call, and he was very excited. He said, "You've got to come down. It's a completely different movie." And I went down there, and on the way, I'm thinking, "How can it be a different movie? What is it now? You know, it's a movie about a guy in a whale, or what?" And and you watch this movie, and they'd taken out a scene of John Cusack sitting in a car, and I just think these people are crazy, you know, that it's really, really not a different movie. It's exactly the same movie, minus the scene of somebody sitting in a car. But it's that thing that, you know, they sit in an editing suite all day and they can convince themselves that they're making some kind of difference.
Writer Nick Hornby speaking with Terry Gross in 2005. His latest novel, A Long Way Down, has just come out in paperback. Let's hear Bob Dylan's song from the soundtrack of High Fidelity, Most of the Time. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Most of the time, I'm clear focused all around. Most of the time, I can keep both feet on the ground. I can follow the path. I can read the sign. Stay right with it. When the road unwinds, I can handle whatever I stumble upon. I don't even notice the sea gone most of the time. Most of the time.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Turner Classic Movies, presenting Race and Hollywood, Black Images on Film, a 38-film retrospective with discussion and commentary Tuesday and Thursday nights in May. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bruce Springsteen's new album is a tribute to the songs of Pete Seeger. Coming up, we'll listen back to a vintage interview with Seeger recorded over 20 years ago. Also, The Da Vinci Code opens in theaters today. We'll have a review. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Pete Seeger is one of the most important figures in the history of American folk music. In the notes to the box set Washington Square Memoirs, Carrie Janelle writes that the image of Seeger, with his homemade long-neck five-string banjo, is synonymous with folk music. Today, only Woody Guthrie equals his status as a folk music icon. Interest in Pete Seeger has revived lately with the release of Bruce Springsteen's album of Seeger songs called We Shall Overcome, The Seeger Sessions. In the 1940s, Seeger sang union songs with the Almanac Singers. A few years later, he co-founded the Weavers, who surprised everyone, including themselves, when they became the first group to bring folk music to the pop charts until they were blacklisted. As a young man, Seeger believed songs were a way of binding people to a cause. and many of his songs were anthems of protest and odes to the working man, like this one about living in a steel town.
Pittsburgh town is a smoky old town, Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh town is a smoky old town, Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh town is a smoky old town, solid iron from McKeesport down, Pittsburgh. Lord God, Pittsburgh. Well, what did Jones and Laughlin steal, Pittsburgh? What did Jones and Laughlin steal, Pittsburgh? What did Jones and Laughlin steal? Up and down the river just as far as you could see in Pittsburgh. Lord God, Pittsburgh. All I do is cough and choke in Pittsburgh. All I do is cough and choke in Pittsburgh. All I do is cough and choke from the iron filings and the sulfur smoke in Pittsburgh. Lord God, Pittsburgh. From the Allegheny.
This summer, Springsteen and his Seeger Sessions band are touring the United States and Europe. Here's the opening track from Springsteen's Seeger Sessions CD, Old Dan Tucker. Seeger is now 87, living on the land in Beacon, New York, that he and his wife Toshi bought in 1949. He doesn't sing much anymore, but he still plays banjo and guitar, and he recently recorded tracks with his half-brother Mike Seeger and Ry Cooter for a project of Cooter's. Seeger said in a recent piece in The New Yorker that while he's gratified by Springsteen's work, he isn't much looking forward to the mail and attention it will bring. Terry spoke to Pete Seeger in 1984, and he told her one of his most important influences was Woody Guthrie.
Well, I'd read about music being a part of people's lives, but I hadn't seen it in action till I met him. And the words that came out of his mouth and the music that he made all flowed together with the life that he had led. And I was greatly attracted to it and kind of tagged along after him for several months. Woody showed me how to hitchhike and how to ride freight trains, how to sing in saloons. I said, what kind of songs are you singing? Well, he said, this year, here's five or six tunes that are nearly always worth a nickel or a quarter if you'll learn them. Makes no difference now what kind of life fate hands me. I'll get along without you now, that's plain to see. It's a Gene Autry hit. Was in 1940.
Was it hard to learn how to jump a railroad car?
No. For a man, it's, of course, for a woman, it'd be much more difficult. The danger of being assaulted by men who assume that any woman who would travel that way has opened his advances. But Woody said, you'd wait in the outskirts of town. And when the train is picking up speed, it's still not going too fast, you can grab a hold of it and swing on. Getting off the first time, I didn't know how to do it, and I fell down and skinned my knees and elbow and broke my banjo. Fortunately, I had a camera with me, and I hocked it in a local pawn shop and bought a very cheap guitar. I didn't have a banjo there, and I knew a few chords, and I got through the rest of the summer playing the guitar.
One of the things you were doing when you were traveling was learning songs from different places, from different people. Did you think that those songs would work, that they'd have the same meaning in the North, in New York, that they had in the places that you learned them from?
Didn't know for sure, but I could try. And I kept writing down fragments of music and poetry everywhere I went. It was from a teenager in Alabama that I got a verse I later on put into a song. I'm so broke, I feel like a dollar bill looks like a window shade. I don't know where he got it, but but I put it into a song years later. And I also got a chance to appreciate the different ways of singing the same song. You know, somebody will sing a song, it's a good song. Hear somebody else sing it, they got different verses, different tune. My father used to say, a folk song printed in a folk song book is a little like a picture of a bird in flight in a bird book. You knew the bird was flapping its wings before that picture was taken and kept on flapping its wings. Similarly, the song in the book was changing before it was written down and kept on changing after it was written down.
You started doing a lot of performing for unions and union halls and even on picket lines. How did you all come up with the songs that you thought would really speak to the people who were there?
Well, a long discussion. When I met Lee Hayes, I met one of the few geniuses I've met in my life. And we were always talking and thinking what kind of songs were needed. If we found a song we liked but felt it needed improving, we'd be trying out this and trying out that. Every day was a new experiment and very exciting. Sometimes one person would start a song and another person would finish it. That's how it was with the song Talking Union. We'd heard Woody singing, you know, the old talking blues. If you want to go to heaven, let me tell you what to do. Got to grease your feet in little mutton stew. Slide out of the devil's hand. Ooze over in the promised land. Take it easy. Go greasy. So on. And I don't know whether it was Lee or Mill or me who thought of, you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. Got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. Got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours. Better working conditions. Vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. They made up most of the first part of the song, and they had one problem after another. Suddenly, we came to a dead stop. How are you going to win? And the song was unfinished for a couple of weeks, maybe. And up on the roof one day, I found myself thinking, well, the only way any of these struggles are won is by the unity of people. So I wrote three more verses, didn't have much rhyme in them, as I remember, but I got the idea across that in spite of all the things that could go wrong, all the attacks that would be made on a group of working people, that you could win if you stuck together.
In 1949, you were one of the people who were supposed to perform at the Paul Robeson concert in Peekskill.
I did. I sang If I Had a Hammer and Tea for Texas. I forgot what else. We Shall Not Be Moved, maybe.
Many other people there
and
were.
And we had stones thrown at us. It was a pretty horrifying day. A lot of people thought this is the beginning of American fascism. This is how Hitler got started. I was just one of 10,000 people there, or 20,000. It was a huge crowd, came to hear Paul Robeson. But the Ku Klux Klan had infiltrated the police force of the county and maybe the state, for all I know, and the city. I don't know the details, but it was the Ku Klux Klan that initiated the attack. And they had the concert surrounded with walkie-talkies, like a battlefield. And after the concert was over, everybody who attended it was directed down one road. There were three roads you could have gone, to the left or straight ahead or to the right. Now, I wanted to go to the left because my home was up there, but the police said, no, all cars down here. And they directed us as though we were going to run the gauntlet. And there are some 15 piles of stones about the size of a baseball, which had been waist high, these stones, thousands of stones, and every car that came by got a stone. Wham! At close range. There was a policeman standing about 80 feet away, and I said, officer, aren't you going to do something? And he said, move on, move on. Then I look around. The guy in back of me was getting stone after stone because he couldn't get past me. I was stopped. So I moved on. Funny, about a year and a half ago, I was out west. And the man says, Pete, you're at Peekskill, weren't you? Yep, I said. He says, do you remember the car in time you stopped and spoke to a policeman? And I said, yeah. And there was a car in back of me again. And he says, I was in that car.
Had he been hurt?
Well, he would have been killed if I hadn't moved on.
We're reaching far back into the Fresh Air archives today to hear a conversation Terry Gross recorded with Pete Seeger in 1984. Bruce Springsteen's album of Seeger songs called We Shall Overcome, The Singer Sessions, was recently released, and Springsteen will be performing those songs during a summer tour. We'll get back to our Pete Seeger interview after this break. This is Fresh Air. Listening to an interview recorded with Pete Seeger in 1984. In the 40s, Seeger co-founded the folk music group The Weavers. Their version of Goodnight Irene became a huge hit when it was released in 1950.
When you were performing with the Weavers, I think that initially you performed at a lot of demonstrations and union halls and outside, and then you made a decision to start trying nightclubs. Was that a big crisis to actually decide to move into the clubs?
That was a soul searching. In one sense, I felt we were going into enemy territory. Why should I want to contribute to the nightclub scene, which I thought was anathema? I come from old New England Puritans who thought nightclubs were the dens of iniquity and never have been much of a drinker myself. But I wanted to reach people. And I remember Woody telling me, Pete, if it's a good experience to sing in a bar, you ought to do it occasionally. So I did. But to take a job in a nightclub and work there 6 nights a week... But we took it, and it was a very valuable experience. We learned a hell of a lot. In 6 months, the Weavers had 6 months of rehearsals and were ready to make some records.
Were you really surprised when your records started getting played on the radio and became big hits?
Yes, we never expected to get on the hit parade. I'd always looked upon Tin Pan Alley as one more snare and a delusion. And if you wanted to make good music, stay away from it. But we met a really charming and wonderful man, Gordon Jenkins, who had a big, slick band, and he said, I'd love to have you record with me. So we took him up on it. And to everybody's surprise, including the head of Decca Records, Goodnight Irene sold 2 million copies in the summer of 1950. It was the biggest seller since World War II, along with one of Bing Crosby's songs. Sam's song was the big seller. But Goodnight Irene was on every jukebox in the USA in the year 1950. You couldn't escape that song. Some people have said, if I hear that song once again, I'm going to kick in that phonograph so it never plays another record. It floated out from every filling station, from every diner.
That might have made it even more difficult than when you were blacklisted.
Well, it made it difficult for the blacklisters, but I didn't expect to last 10 minutes. I thought the blacklisters would be after us a lot sooner. It took them a couple of years to chop us down, and it was a full 5 years before they got around to calling me up before the Committee on Un-American Activities. I was surprised it took so long.
You wanted to sing a song to the committee, right?
I think I did. They questioned me about a song. I said, oh, that's a good song. I'll sing it to you. Well, no, they didn't want me to sing it. They wanted to know where I had sung it, at the following place. I said, well, I have a right to sing a song anywhere I want to, whether it's I agree with the people or don't agree with them. I'm not interested in telling you that. They said, we direct you to tell us. I said, no. He said, you are liable to be under contempt of Congress. Do you use the Fifth Amendment as your defense? No, I said, I just don't think these are questions any American should be asked, especially under threat of reprisal if they give the wrong answer. So in effect, I was defending myself on the basis of the First Amendment. See, the Fifth Amendment in effect says you have no right to ask me this question, But the First Amendment, in effect, says you have no right to ask any American such questions.
Have the wounds ever healed among the folk musicians who were friendly witnesses and those who weren't before UAC?
I think it's been harder for the friendly witnesses. History has not been kind to the Un-American Activities Committee. It feels, as I felt, that these people didn't love America so much as their own particular version of America, which was somewhat limited, shall we say. And so those who cooperated with the committee, I wish they could forget it all. Those who stood up to the committee, as Lee says, if it wasn't for the honor, he'd just as soon not been blacklisted. It was an honor.
Do you think there's any conservative equivalent of progressive folk music?
Well, I think the word conservative and radical are often misleading terms. This is very conservative music in many ways. There are so-called conservative political songs. There have been Ku Klux Klan songs. Woody and I put one in a book years ago. Hallelujah, I'm a Ku Klux. Hallelujah, amen. Hallelujah, I'm a Ku Klux. I belong to the Klan. We put it in a song called Hard-Hitting Songs for Hard-Hit People, and Woody kind of satirized it. His father had worked with the Klan. His father had participated in a lynching down in Oklahoma. And one of the wonderful things about Woody Guthrie was his growing out of the racism that his family knew as a child, and meeting black people and writing songs. He wrote a great ballad of Isaac Woodard, this GI who went back to visit his home in the South and was insulted by a bus driver, and next thing he was arrested and beaten and blinded for the rest of his life. And Woody wrote a long ballad about it. It's a wonderful ballad. Woody was a direct actionist. When he was singing once to raise money for war bonds during World War II, he and Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee were in Baltimore. And they said, "Mr. Guthrie, we have a seat for you at the table, and your friends, we have some food for them in the kitchen." He said, "What do you mean?" He tipped the whole table up in a big crowded dining hall, dumped a whole table full of plates and everything on the floor, and tipped another table up. Finally, he was restrained. And Brownie says, "Woody, you're going to get us all in trouble. I'm lame and Sonny's blind." And they let him out. He was absolutely furious. Now, part of his education, here's what happened. Before he met a lot of radicals, he was singing country songs on a little station in California, and he sang a song with a lot of dialect. It was probably an old minstrel song, "Eyes gwine cross de ribber." And he got a letter. "Dear Mr. Guthrie, I think you mean well or I would not bother to write, but don't you know that kind of dialect is deeply offensive to people like me? We like your music, but that dialect is unnecessary. It's a relic of slavery." Woody, next day on his program, read the man's letter on the air. He said, "Folks, I just read you this guy's letter. Now I'm picking up a copy of that song. Now you listen, I got the copy of this song right near the microphone." And he took up that song and he held it near the microphone. He tore it into strips right in front of the microphone. That was Woody Guthrie.
Pete Seeger speaking with Terry in 1984. He's now 87, living with his wife in Beacon, New York. Bruce Springsteen recently recorded an album of songs Seeger performed. Springsteen and his Seeger Sessions band will be touring the United States and Europe over the summer.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
miner's son. He'll be with you fellow workers until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on? Sing it! Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews The Da Vinci Code. This is Fresh Air. Dan Brown's best-selling novel, The Da Vinci Code, is second only to the Harry Potter series as the best-selling novel of all time, and it's inspired a whole slew of books on biblical puzzles, Opus Dei, and the life of Mary Magdalene, as well as some debunking Brown's premise. Now comes director Ron Howard's long-anticipated film, starring Tom Hanks and Audrey Tautou. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Columbia Pictures wouldn't let anyone see The Da Vinci Code until a couple of days ago, so there was nothing much for the media to report on except the protests of Catholics and other Christian groups. But it turns out the real story is that the mega-budget movie is an embarrassing non-event. Any Catholic leader who actually sits through it will probably tell the picketers to go home. I should mention that those leaders aren't paranoid. Dan Brown's best-selling novel really is an assault on the foundations of their faith. Brown isn't the only person to speculate on the political intentions behind the writing of the Gospels, but he ratchets up the stakes by spinning a counter-theory revolving around Mary Magdalene and by making the Catholic Opus Dei sect a bastion of homicidal zealots determined to suppress the truth. Throw in car chases, a mutilated corpse in the Louvre, skulking bishops, a mysterious criminal mastermind, a self-flagellating killer albino, and cryptogrammatic clues hidden in masterpieces of Western art, and you've got yourself a publishing phenomenon that even a lot of churchgoers couldn't resist. The director Ron Howard and the screenwriter Akiva Goldsman have made little of all this. The movie is divinely uninspired. It's a shaggy grail story without a whisper of passion, not even the passion for intellectual gamesmanship that buttressed all the sentimental glop in their best-known collaboration, A Beautiful Mind. What keeps you turning pages in the novel is the mixture of Hitchcock and Will Shortz, a man wrongfully accused of murder hurtling from place to place while madly solving the puzzles left by the dead guy. But Howard and Goldsman have come up with a deadly blend, a movie both really slow and impossible to follow. I feel a little sorry for Tom Hanks, who plays the wrongfully accused puzzle solver, the famed Harvard symbologist Robert Langdon. The Da Vinci Code was obviously a money job for him, and the money was obviously great, but it has to be rough on a smart actor when there's nothing to play, no subtext, no strong objective, and no one much to play against. His co-star is Audrey Tautou, miscast as a French cryptologist and the granddaughter of the dead Louvre curator. As an actress, she seems bred for airy enchantment, not earthy gumption, and her very approximate English diction turns even rudimentary dialogue into a linguistic adventure. Here, she and Hanks contemplate something pulled from a safe deposit box called a cryptex.
Cryptex? They're used to keep secrets. It's Da Vinci's design. You write the information on a papyrus scroll, which is then rolled around a thin glass vial of vinegar. If you force it open, the vial breaks, vinegar dissolves papyrus, and your secret is lost forever. The only way to access the information is to spell out the password with these. 5 dials, each with 26 letters. That's 12 million possibilities.
I've never met a girl who knew that much about a cryptex.
Sonia made one for me once.
My grandfather gave me a wagon.
While she describes the cryptex, we see the interior workings of it. It's like an insert in CSI, and I normally find scenes like that hard to resist. But Ron Howard can't manage to generate any momentum or suspense. And Goldsman does such a poor job of storytelling that the subversive goddess worship doesn't have any impact either. The only diversions in the movie are Sir Ian McKellen's scenery chewing and the miscast but game Paul Bettany doing his best to embody religious dementia as the Opus Dei albino. If there's anything to be learned from this dud, it's that when you adapt an explosive property like the Da Vinci Code, playing it safe isn't safe. Either swallow hard and make the damnable thing, or give it to someone with more guts and or less to lose. Here's a saga that strikes at the heart of Western religion, and it plays like there's absolutely nothing at stake.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. From Judy and Steve Hopkins, supporting the Shakespeare Theater's production of Pericles, May 25th through June 4th at the Carter Barron Amphitheater, Washington, D.C. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Leonard Cohen chooses his words carefully. On the next Fresh Air, the poet and singer joins us to talk about his career, his new volume of poems, and his upcoming album. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
If you want a lover, I'll do anything you ask.